We should get started, and then people can join as they come in. So let's close the eyes and sit up nice, comfortable, tall. Relax for a moment. Recite Om three times. So take a deep breath in. You open the eyes softly now. So welcome everybody. Namaste and welcome to our session, monthly session on Yoga Sutras. Okay. So when we do a study of the sutras, we start with an invocation to sage Patanjali. So let me bring that screen up and then we can all read it or chant it together. Let me share that screen first. So this is an invocation to sage Patanjali, which we always recite before we start any discussion or study of Patanjali. It's got a little meter, a little tune to it. So I'll sing it. You can either close the eyes and listen in or just read along with me on the screen. Yogena chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarottam pravaram muninam Patanjalim Pranjaliran Tosmi. Patanjalim Pranjaliran Tosmi. Okay. Always like one of you to read the translation in English. Maybe Becca, you want to read the translation, please?
I respectfully bow down with folded hands and offer my salutations to Sage Patanjali, the highest among the munis, or sages, who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through the treatise of Ayurveda, of language, through his treatise on grammar, and the impurities of the citta through his treatise on yoga.
It's all right.
Yeah, I'm mispronouncing English and Sanskrit.
That's good. You have to try. thank you. And so this is the invocation, and very quickly, as you have noticed from this invocation, Patanjali is given the credit for all these three sciences, which are the most important for human well-being and communication, etc. So the science of Ayurveda for cleaning out our body or purifying our body or giving us health, physical health. That's the Ayurveda. He also gave us the most authoritative, most regarded, highest regarded commentary on the Sanskrit grammar called the Mahabhashya. And then finally, he gave us this science of yoga to cleanse our mind, to purify the mind. Okay, so Yoga Sutras of Patanjali to cleanse or purify the mind. So that's the whole kind of brief description of Patanjali, our great sage. Okay, go back to that screen later, but let's go through a brief round of introductions. Many of you are new today. All right, so just tell us your name, where you're located, and why did you decide to join this session today? All right, start with Arvind. I'm going alphabetically on my list. Arvind, you have to unmute yourself before you speak.
Sorry, I was on mute. Guys, my name is Arvind Subramaniam, and I'm based in Morrisville, North Carolina. I've been doing these programs with Subhash on and off. I have completed the Pranayama intensive with Subhash, and I do practice that. I'm a practitioner as well. I've been wanting to participate in this YSP program for a while, but commitments and different things have kept me from being able to do it. But this is a weekend where I said I want to join and listen in and try to understand a little bit more. So
welcome.
That's why I'm here. Thank you.
Glad you found the time. Okay. All right. Ashish.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Ashish Bhateja. Currently, I'm based in Philippines. So I'm from Manila. That's why you see the dark background. I'm still new to the Patanjali Sutra. The first time I heard of them is about 2 years back when I was in Delhi and I went to the bookshop asking for a good book on yoga. And I came back with this book called Patanjali Sutras, which I did not open for a long time until during this lockdown about 3 months back. I was briefly associated with one of the Iyengar teachers. That was also my first exposure to the Iyengar style of yoga, and they open with the Patanjali Sutra. That's where my curiosity started, and I started researching on what's the right way to pronounce, what does this mean. So that was when my discovery about Patanjali Sutra started. And as a beginner, they were not easy at all. They're still not easy for me to understand. So when Subhashi announced this session, I immediately signed up. So that's me, basically. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ashish. Very nice of you. Becca, next.
Hi, I'm Becca. I am based in Raleigh, but today I'm at the coast and it's raining. It's really nice. And I am part of a teacher training program that's based in Raleigh through a studio, and this is part of the curriculum. But I, just having read translations of the sutras and have seen a lot of parallels with the philosophies that I grew up with, and just interested in digging in and learning more. So very excited for the opportunity to learn.
Thank you, Becca. Wonderful. Okay, Eleanor.
My name is Eleanor Lee, and I'm in Cary, North Carolina. And I'm here today to improve my knowledge of the yoga philosophy. I enjoy the sessions, and I feel like I get a lot out of them, but it seems like whenever we're done and I have to apply it to my daily life, it gets a little difficult. So that's the part I need to work on. So that's why I'm here.
You're not alone there. Thank you, Eleanor. Okay, Jackie.
Hello, my name is Jackie. I am in teacher training with Becca right now. I'm in Raleigh as well. And like she said, it's part of the curriculum, but we sort of started reading them a little bit, and we were able to dig in a little, but I think this will help us learn a lot more, and I'm really interested in learning a lot more about them. So thank you for this.
Thank you. Thank you, Jackie. John?
Sorry, I was muted. I'm John. I live in New Jersey. Subhash probably as a introduced me to the Yoga Sutras about 20 years ago as a thing, but I wasn't ready really to understand or really explore it at the time. And then I probably took about 15 years off from any sort of real yoga practice. And about a year ago, I became acquainted with some new friends who were practicing yoga, and I started practicing yoga with them again. And the Yoga Sutras became part, you know, something that was becoming a little bit more real. And I have a different place in my life now that I think they have more meaning, or at least I can sort of get my head around it a little bit better. And then, as I think maybe somebody on here knows, I jumped in right after the pandemic shut down, quarantine. Subhash offered a Yoga Sutra intensive that I just stumbled into and spent a couple weeks learning more. But it's so much. So anytime I see there's sort of an opportunity that fits into life generally to, I don't know, sit, listen, explore a little bit more, there just seems to be a lot of good stuff to kind of pull away. But it's, you know, there's no way. I think you could spend lifetimes trying to get through a couple of the sutras. So I don't know. I'll listen. We'll talk and have fun. I do enjoy it though. It's nice. Thank you.
Thank you, John. And Nancy.
Hi, I'm Nancy Benson. I live in Durham, North Carolina, and have known about this for some time. I don't remember how long ago it's been since I first took the pranayama with Subhash. Years, at least probably 6 years or something. And so I've known about this for a long time, and it was always kind of a challenge to get it into my schedule on Saturday afternoon. And so I saw, you know, how things happen at the right time. I guess it was last month, right before the session, I saw the mail, which I see the mail every time it comes, but this time I actually saw the mail and I was like, I'm doing this. So I'm really excited. So last month was my first time, and I've had the book for I don't know how many years since you first told us about it, Subhash, the one of the books that you had recommended, but just opened it last month for the first time. And the part that I'm finding to be interesting is how I feel so drawn to the Sanskrit. And you know, obviously the information is very you know, and I'm also drawn to that, but the Sanskrit part just seems to be like that extra thing that really is pulling me, wow, pulling me in. So I'm excited. I'm really excited about that too. So looking forward to being on this journey.
Wonderful. Thank you and welcome everyone. I don't think anybody else there. Okay. So this is a kind of a series that I've been doing for a while now, and I kind of keep recycling it once we are done with this whole sequence. And I believe we started this about 8 or 9 months ago. I do this once a month, as I mentioned, and we started with chapter one. So for those of you who are, does everyone know that it has four chapters? And I think everyone knows that, right? It's four chapters. And the name of the chapters are Samadhipada is chapter number one, Sadhana Pada is chapter number two, Vibhuti Pada is chapter number three, and Kaivalya Pada is chapter number four. Those are the names of those chapters. Just a very brief overview. The first chapter contains the kind of the very definition of yoga as to what yoga is and what are some of these the components of yoga. And then it talks about the state, the ultimate state of yoga, which is called Samadhi. And then it talks at fairly great length about the different stages of Samadhi, etc. That's the first chapter. Second chapter actually discusses some of the very basic underlying fundamental philosophical concepts of yoga, which are called the Sankhya philosophy. So chapter two is a lot of Sankhya philosophy, but then it starts out with a discussion of the Klesha. Klesha is all the suffering and afflictions that we go through. And finally, it introduces the concept of the eight limbs of yoga. Okay, eight limbs of yoga is what Patanjali prescribes to get rid of this all this suffering that we go through and finally attain self-realization. Okay, the third chapter is Vibhuti, which is to attain, you know, which talks about the attainment of supernormal powers through the practice of yoga, through the practice of meditation. And then finally, the Kaivalya is the state of the being where you have attained self-realization and you've understood the true identity that you have. So those are the four chapters at a very high level. Okay. So in our sessions so far, what we've done is I started with chapter one and we only did the first 15 or 16 or so sutras. Okay. And then I jumped to chapter two. And then I went through chapter two, every sutra, you know, and in chapter two, we do not skip any sutras there. So right from number one all the way up to where we are today. And again, like I mentioned, the very basic core of chapter two is to understand the underlying Sankhya philosophy. How many of you have not heard of the term Sankhya? Raise your hands. Okay. All right. So almost nobody has heard the term Sankhya. Now, Sankhya is the very underlying, you know, there are several systems of philosophy. In fact, there are six systems of philosophy in India. And Sankhya and yoga kind of go together. Okay. And from what we see, Patanjali has used some of the very basic concepts from Sankhya and use that as the background or the underlying philosophy for development of his Yoga Sutra philosophy. So that's where we spent a fair amount of time understanding those sutras, which go into a nice detail of the Sankhya philosophy. And since, you know, it is kind of important to just know what the basics of Sankhya are, I'm tempted to go over that chart one more time. I know Eleanor has seen that many times. John has seen it, but but let me see if I can pull it up. Just one second. Okay. So let's see, how can I go to? Oops. Okay, so I'm going to share the screen and just go through this. All right. The reason, like I said, I want to show this is because, you know, at the back of our mind, even though in our discussion today, we won't be touching anything about Sankhya philosophy, but I still want to do this because we did this in the last two or three sessions. We spent a lot of time on Sankhya. And as per this philosophy, you know, there are these elements of evolution, which we go through as a part of the evolution process. This is how the human body, human being is kind of constructed in a sense. You know, these are the elements or the constituents of the human being, okay? So if you go through this quickly, the chart, on the left, I'm showing this soul or consciousness called Purusha, which is connected through a dotted line. Okay. That means there's a soft connection between the two. Okay. And then there's this Prakriti is the whole material entity that we are a part of. That's what is called Prakriti, the unmanifest here. Now, when the manifestation happens, this is roughly, and I'm going to go through very quickly. This is not something that I can spend a lot of time on. But just to give you a brief idea, you know, there's this, the first thing that gets created is the intellect. intellect, which is the buddhi or the discriminatory function. Then the ego gets into the picture next. Then ego branches off into two branches and then creates these mind, five sense organs, and five organs of action. So very quickly, the sense organs are the eye, ear, nose, skin, and the tongue. And the organs of action are the hands, feet, speech, the organs of elimination, and procreation. Okay. All right, so as you can see, Nancy, you said you're intrigued by Sanskrit. So each one of these words, I have also given you these Sanskrit words that are associated with all these eyes, ears, etc. So what they are known as Sanskrit. Okay. And then and on this side, you have these subtle sense perceptions, the sense of sound, touch, form, taste, and smell. And then finally, the five great elements called Mahabhutas, ether or the space, air, fire, water, and ether. Earth, yeah. Okay. This is, I just wanted to bring it up because this is a very important concept in our Sankhya philosophy. And this will, in different form, it will appear into our Yoga Sutra discussions. May not be taught today, but every now and then it will come. Okay. And then we'll refer back to this chart whenever we need to. That now. All right, so after, you know, we discussed these sutras related to Sankhya philosophy, what Patanjali said in the last, in the part that we finished last time, is that the whole idea of all these yoga practices, etc., is to eventually cleanse the mind so that the intellect becomes very sharp. That's the idea, you know. And this intuitive wisdom, the word that Patanjali used was prajna, P-R-A-J-N-A. Prajna was the word used by Patanjali. He said, by cleansing the mind, this intuitive wisdom called prajna will shine through. When that shines through, that's the only time you can really have a glimpse of your true nature. Okay? But that doesn't happen because of our ignorance. It's called avidya. Avidya is the ignorance of not knowing who we are. And because of this avidya, the ego takes over. And when the ego takes over, we are in all kinds of a mess, because then ego works on all the past impressions, etc. So that's the background, okay? And then Patanjali goes into this whole discussion of the eight limbs of yoga. That's where we are today. So today, from today onwards, we are going to start discussing the eight limbs of yoga. Okay? So that, he says, when you do that, that will get you to your goal of attaining self-realization, etc., etc. Okay. So once again, I'm going to share the screen so we can go through this sequence. All right, let me share the screen. Okay. So the it starts with the with an introduction to these eight limbs of yoga. All right, and the sutra number 28 is where it gives the introduction to these limbs of yoga, eight limbs of yoga. So typically what we do in this class is that I first read the Sanskrit phrase word by word. Then I try to give you the meaning of each word so that you know what these words mean. Okay, and then kind of the overall translation. All right. When I have the class in person, I make everyone actually repeat every word with me, Sanskrit word, okay? But we won't do that now, be online. Okay, so I'll just read these words. And the sutra is Yogang Anushthanat Ashuddhikshaye Jnana Deeptihi A Vivek Khyatehe. That's the Sanskrit phrase. Okay? So what it's saying is that you know, I'm going to kind of break the words one by one. Yoga Anga. Okay, Anga means limbs. Limbs. Anga is the word for limb. Yoga Anga means the limbs of yoga. The word Anushthana means practice. Okay, Anushthana. I should be pointing here because you can't read the Sanskrit. The Anushthana means practice. So what it means is through the practice of yoga, your limbs of yoga. So the first phrase here, Yoga Anga Anushthana, means through the practice of yoga, the limbs of yoga, what happens? Ashuddhi kshaye. The word ashuddhi, it comes from shuddhi. Shuddhi means purity. When you add the prefix a, it becomes the negative, impurity. All right. So kshaye means to diminish, to eliminate sometimes, or diminish at least. Okay. So all the impurities are diminished. And then what happened? Jnana deeptihi. Jnana means knowledge. Deepti means light. Okay. So the light of wisdom. Knowledge here literally means wisdom, you know, true innate wisdom that we have. That shines through. Okay. And that because we have no more impurities in the mind, we are able to see that true light of wisdom, which was hidden from us because of the ego and because of all the impurities. It was always hidden from us. But now that light shines through and then keeps that cleansing, that purification and shining of the light continues to go on until means until Viveka Khyatehi. Viveka is pure discriminatory wisdom. That is, you know, your wisdom, which is totally uncluttered or you know, not combined with any kind of egoistic tendency, pure wisdom, okay? And when that knowledge, that khyati means knowledge, when that knowledge happens, then you are self-realized. That's the time when you have attained what Patanjali calls the state of kaivalya. Kaivalya means pure being, pure independence. Independence from this whole mess that we are in, basically, if I want to call it that way. Okay? So that is the sutra here. It's a very, I call it a, you know, it's a very beautiful sutra because it kind of gives you a very nice description of what yoga can do for us, what yoga is supposed to do for us, okay? All the eight limbs of yoga. So the translation that we have here is, by the practice of the limbs of yoga, the impurities dwindle away and there dawns the light of wisdom, leading to discriminatory discernment. Okay? And this is the discernment that we're looking for, which will give us total self-realization. Okay? The English translation for most of the sutra that I have is from the book by Swami Satchidananda. Okay? And some translations which I, you know, I'm not very comfortable with, but I'll mention that if that happens anytime. So again, what kind of, you know, this is a set of notes that I've made based on, you know, my reading some of the commentaries by different authors. Okay, so the first phrase was ashuddhi kshaye, which means on elimination of impurities. Okay, what kind of impurities are we talking about? At the physical level, you have, you know, all these impurities like sickness, etc. I've mentioned. Okay. And they are listed in sutras 130 and 131, all right? And let me see if it makes sense to go to that slide, or even if I can find that slide. Probably not too easily. All right, let me see. Okay, this new slide that I opened, you can't see that, right? I have to stop the other share and then go back to this share. Hold on a second.
We could see 130. I saw 130.
Oh, you did see that?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, then that's what I was looking at. Okay.
It's good. It's visible.
Okay. So, you know, the reason what, so at the you know, what are the impurities that we're talking about? You know, generally commentators say that this is what is listed in Sutra 130. And I'm just going to read the list here. Disease, dullness, doubt, carelessness, laziness, sensuality, false perception, failure to reach firm ground, and then slipping from the ground gained. Okay, these are the distractions of the mind. You can call them impurities of the mind, of the body. Okay. And there's a description here of all these. And then also it talks about the accompaniments to all these mental or these distractions are the distress, despair, trembling of the body, and very disturbed breathing. All right. So that's kind of the gist of these two, which are more physical, mental combined impurities of the body and mind. That's the, and now are you back to Sutra number 228? Can you see that?
No, we still see 131.
I'm not sure how the share screen works very well, but let me go back to sharing the screen now.
Yes, we see 228 now.
Okay. And then the other thing that Patanjali mentions in terms of the impurities or the afflictions are the five kleshas. Okay, five kleshas are the suffering or the afflictions that we go through in mind. Okay, does anybody remember the five kleshas? We've talked about it many times.
Ignorance, egoism, attachment, hatred, and clinging to bodily life.
Very good, yeah, very good. So these are the five kleshas, which starts with ignorance about, you know, not knowing who I am, what my true reality is. And then that gives birth to, you know, this strong egoistic sense, you know, ego takes over our life basically because we don't know what our real nature is. So ego says, okay, if you don't know who you are, I know who I am and I'll take over and I'll guide your life. And it leads our life into misery. So that's what ego does. And then when the ego takes over, it gives birth to raga and dvesha, which she said are strong attachment and dislikes, etc. Likes and dislikes. I like this. I dislike it. Love it. I hate it. I want it. I don't want it. So those are the things that the ego gives birth to. And then finally, it also creates a strong fear of death and a strong desire to cling to your bodily life. Okay, so those are the five kleshas that are mentioned in the chapter 2. And then there are these six enemies that are very commonly listed in our literature. These are not listed in this sequence in the sutras, but these are very commonly mentioned in Indian literature of any kind. If you look at anything, any older text as to what are the different enemies of the mind, and these will be listed here. Okay, so these enemies are lust or craving, which is called kama, krodha is anger, lobha is greed, moha is delusion or infatuation, and mada is arrogance, and matsarya is jealousy. Okay, so these are the six very commonly experienced emotions, I should call them. You know, we go through these from our day to day, in our daily life, in some form or another. But, and we also know that these are, you know, very harmful for us. They keep our mind in a state which doesn't function very clearly then, because if you are angry, you know, you cannot function clearly. Same as with greed, or if you are too much drawn into greed or arrogance, etc. The mind cannot function clearly. So these are the enemies of the mind. So that's what it says here. Okay. So at the, like I said, at the physical and mental level, those are the sicknesses that we talked about. disease, dullness, etc. There was Sutra number 130. And then five kleshas, which is the ignorance, starting with ignorance and the ego, likes and dislikes, and fear of death. Those are the five kleshas. And then Shatriputs, you know, six enemies. Okay, so these are the six enemies that we always kind of go through in life. So what Patanjali is saying is that we need to work on all these. Okay, so that's not a small task to eliminate all these in our life. It could take a while, but that's what he says yoga can do for us, these eight limbs of yoga eventually. So once these impurities are cleaned out, then what happens? That's when Jnana Deepti, or the light or the glow of pure wisdom, comes through. So the glow of pure innate intuitive wisdom, uncorrupted by the ego, that comes through. Okay. So far we have been all corrupted by the ego. All these are egoistic based, all these things that we mentioned, all the impurities. But then when the impurities begin to kind of dwindle away, now we are able to see that pure light of wisdom. Okay. And then what happens is, when we have that pure light of wisdom, it eventually leads us to a pure Viveka Khyati, which means discrimination between Purusha and Prakriti. Okay.
Would you talk a little bit more about what that means?
About the last one?
Yes.
Okay, so that's the whole concept behind yoga, is to learn what is Purusha and what is Prakriti. Purusha is the pure soul. You know, you can think of it as the self with a capital S, as we say, Atma, or, you know, essence of being, that's pure soul. And then Prakriti is everything that's material counterpart, of which we are, you know, the physical being is a part of, material counterpart. That's the Prakriti. And those 25 elements that we saw, that's part of the Prakriti. Remember that elements we saw that? Okay. So on the one side, we had Purusha on the left side, where, on that chart that we just saw. Okay, left side was Purusha. And on the right side was this whole, the tree of Prakriti, or the evolution tree, all right? Now, what is happening is, because of ignorance, because we don't know what our reality is, the Purusha, or the self, doesn't recognize its true nature, and it kind of gets entangled with the ego, with the Prakriti, okay? And the ego takes over, all right? Like I said, ego takes over. The Purusha, or the self, has kind of lost its own real nature. It doesn't know what it is and who it is and what it's doing. And it starts acting as if it's also enjoying, you know, things that are pleasurable. It's also getting suffering because there are some things which are not, you know, palatable for us. So it goes through these cycles of joy and sorrow and happiness and anger and all that stuff. That's because of the entanglement of the Purusha, which is supposed to be pure, and clean. It has no end or beginning, but then it gets messed up. That's the unfortunate part. And that's where we are. You know, we are all in that state of what I call messed up state, okay? Because we don't know our true identity. Okay? So that is the whole goal of yoga, is to learn how to see that separation, that I'm really not connected with this Prakriti. I'm close to it. I need the Prakriti to have an experience of life. So that proximity is very essential. At the same time, the separation is very essential. It's separation, but based on proximity. Proximity is essential because without that, the two cannot function together. So I cannot have any experience of life at all. All right. So with that proximity and that separateness means now I can just sit and enjoy. I can sit and watch, basically. That the word Patanjali uses in chapter one is drashta. Drashta means the seer, or the observer, or the one who is just experiencing things without being attached, without being entangled with anything. Okay. So that's the goal. The goal is to realize who you are, not get entangled, and yet stay in proximity so that you can have fun. Fun without any attachment. Enjoy life, basically. Does that make sense, Eleanor?
Yes. I guess the question is that for each person, we all struggle with trying to eliminate these impurities so we're not so attached to the prakriti. You know, basically on a day-to-day basis, things happen and that's when the ego kicks in and you just, you know, it's hard to not form that union between the two things. So, yeah.
Yeah. You know, Patanjali doesn't say it's easy, so and that's why, you know, he says that it can take multiple lifetimes to get there. he doesn't make it any easy, but you know.
Like also, I wanted to tell everybody that I don't remember all the stuff, is that I've just made up my own cheat sheet. When I come to these sessions, I can always look at this piece of paper.
That's good, good. We all need a cheat sheet for life. Okay, so that's the sutra here. All right. Any more questions on this one? Like I said, this is a very nice sutra. It tells us what yoga can do for us. Eventually leads to self-realization. Okay, how do you do that? So these are the 8 limbs of yoga that will help us get there. All right. Okay. So what are the 8 limbs of yoga? It'd be nice if somebody else read the slide. Okay. Nancy, can you read the 8 limbs of yoga?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Okay, so the 8 limbs of yoga: yama, which is restraint; niyama, observance; asana, posture; pranayama, regulation of breath; pratyahara, withholding of senses; dharana, fixity; dhyana, meditation; and samadhi, perfect concentration, are the 8 limbs of yoga.
Okay, wonderful. So again, the words are yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Okay, so those are the 8 limbs of yoga. That's what we'll be studying. Right. Okay. It's just a listing again of the same 8 limbs of yoga. Okay. Again, this is just a few notes based on some of the other sutras that, you know, that come later. The first 5 are called the external limbs and the last 3 are called internal limbs. Again, depends on where you are in your practice. But from the point of view of seedless samadhi, all the 8 are external. Okay, so it's just a way to understand what is external and internal. And some commentators believe that these limbs are sequential. Others believe that they can be practiced all together. It doesn't matter. You know, it depends on the commentator. In my own practice, and I think in most practices, you will feel that they are, you know, you can practice in any order and you can just mix and match all these things. That's what I have found. So I don't believe that they are sequential in any real sense. Some are, you know. Don't have to be. Like the last 3, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, they are sequential in a sense, okay? But the others don't have to. Now, what I've done here is, you know, is to kind of compare this with the Eightfold Path of Buddhism. Is anybody familiar with the Buddhist Eightfold Path? Anybody had studied Buddhism at all? Anyone? No? Okay. You know, Buddha also talks about the Eightfold Path, which leads to, again, self-realization. And the reason I bring it up is because there is, you know, among the historians, there is a belief that these two lived very close to each other, if no more than 200 to 300 years apart, if at all. Okay, because there are commonalities in the philosophy that's presented by both Buddha and Patanjali. Who influenced who? That's the question. You know, the historians kind of debate whether Patanjali was influenced by Buddha or vice versa. Okay, but there are many similarities. And when we talked about those similarities when we were doing the Sankhya philosophy also. Okay, so if you recall that, we talked about some of those similarities there. So just to kind of very quickly go over this, we don't have to spend any time. But what he's talking about, the right view, one should know and contemplate the Four Noble Truths. Okay, again, there are Four Noble Truths, which is exactly the same thing that Patanjali talks about, that there is suffering, there is a cause of suffering, and there is a way to negate that suffering, and what is the way, okay? And that way is this Eightfold Path, all right? And the next is right resolve or intention, right intention, and the commitment to ethical and mental self-improvement. Right speech, right conduct or action, okay? And again, you know, here also, you know, Buddha gives very similar concepts as we have in the Yamas and Niyamas, you know, that we'll come to that. And again, the right conduct here is to abstain from harming ahimsa, just like in yoga, taking what is not given, which is asteya in yoga, it's exactly the same thing. Sexual misconduct, brahmacharya, truthfulness, which is satya, okay? And then not taking intoxicating drinks and drugs. That's very strong part of Buddhism, not taking intoxicating drinks and drugs. And then avoiding untimely meals, etc., are also mentioned, okay? But then Buddha also talks about aparigraha, which is non-greediness in some other context, which is a part of the Patanjali's. Okay. Right livelihood, okay, right effort, mental energy and the force behind right effort, etc. I'm not going to go through anything, but right mindfulness, samyak smriti. Mindfulness, again, now we're going into more of the concentration and meditation parts, right? Concentration it talks about here. Samyak samadhi. Okay. So very similar in approach and the even some of the terminology is very similar. So, you know, Buddha and Patanjali, they kind of go closely together in some sense. Of course, there are differences also, major differences. I mean, you know, Buddhism, they don't recognize the existence of soul or purusha or anything as a substratum level. Okay? Patanjali is a strong believer in this soul or purusha part. Okay, so there are yamas, niyamas, etc. Remember, so there are five yamas. Okay, so what are the yamas here? The Sanskrit words are ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, and aparigraha. Those are the five yamas. Now, one way to look at these yamas and niyamas are that each are five, right? Five yamas and five niyamas. And one way to look at them is that yamas represent those guidelines which involve social interaction. So you're interacting with others, okay? That's social interaction guidelines. And then the niyamas are those guidelines which apply to you yourself, kind of apply to yourself in a more disciplinary manner, all right? And so we talk about these things now. So what is ahimsa? Ahimsa is non-violence. Satya is truthfulness. Asteya is non-stealing. Brahmacharya is continence or celibacy. And aparigraha is non-greed, okay, or non-hoarding. Actually, I should say non-hoarding here. Greed is a cause, but the effect is hoarding. Okay. So that's more like non-hoarding. Oh, that's what I have written here, non-hoarding. So this is Swami Satchidananda's text, and I have modified it. Okay. And then what he says is that these five, and we'll come to these individually, okay, non-injury, etc., you know, we'll talk about these. But what Patanjali says here, this is the only place where Patanjali makes a very strong statement. Otherwise, he doesn't make any strong statement at all. He just gives you his ideas and, you know, it's like take it or leave it kind of a thing. But here he says, if you want to follow this path, then this is what I have to say. What does it say? Let me read the Sanskrit phrase here. And the words are, jati, desha, kala, samaya, anavachinnaha, sarvabhaumaha, mahavratam. Okay, that's the Sanskrit phrase. Okay. I know some of you don't care about Sanskrit, and I'm fully aware of that. And you don't know anything about Sanskrit, and you don't care about Sanskrit. But the reason I always like to at least read these words in Sanskrit is because every piece of knowledge that comes to us from the ancient times, all of it is written in Sanskrit. All of it. Almost without exception. So all the Vedas, all the Upanishads, the Gita, Bhagavad Gita, all the Purana, Yoga Sutra, and all the six philosophical systems, everything was presented to us in this language called Sanskrit. Okay? And there are words and phrases in Sanskrit which are non-translatable. Non-translatable. You cannot. The moment you translate them, you destroy their meaning. Or distort their meaning. Okay, that's just the way things are. But then, if you don't know Sanskrit, you have no other way except to look at some translation, which could be distorted, and then, of course, your own understanding will be distorted. But that's okay. That's the nature of things. But then, I try to at least present the words and their meaning as I understand them. Okay, so my understanding of the meaning of each word, I like to present. Okay, so. Jati is usually, you know, given the term jati used for class. In India, you know, there is a class structure, or it's called the varna, or the system of class. And there are, in the society, there are four different varnas, or four classes in the society. Does anybody know that at all? Anybody familiar with these concepts in India? Does anybody know the five the four classes in India? Anybody heard about them? John, have you heard about it?
I know they exist, but I don't truly understand it.
Okay.
I'm aware of them, but I don't really understand the interplay between them all.
All right. So it doesn't matter. We won't go into any kind of detail there. But it's a class structure, basically, you know, based on your ability, based on your birth. A lot of things happen there. And it has been distorted over the years, as you can imagine, in the society, everything gets distorted. In India, it got distorted to an extent where it has caused large amount of damage to the country. Okay, I'll leave it at that. So, the structure that exists today is way, way, way off from where it was intended to be.
Since you brought this up, when most Indian Americans come over here and live their life, does this idea of class fall away when you're here?
Not necessarily. Okay. especially in terms of, I would say, especially in terms of marriage, etc., they're still followed to some extent. You know, people still like to get married within their own structure, you know, and not go too far out, etc. But yeah, in general, they fall away. In general, yes. Not a whole lot left. Yeah.
Subhashi, a question. In terms of sequencing, the Yoga Sutras come after the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, or, I mean, any hints on how they are sequenced?
I believe they are after Mahabharata, yes.
They are after Mahabharata. Okay. Yes,
yeah, much later. Okay, so this word desha, desha means location, place. The common meaning of the word desha is country, any location, basically physical location, you know, etc. Kala means time. Okay, kala means time. And samaya also means time, but in this case, it means the situation or the circumstance that you're placed in. Okay, so this is where Patanjali says that it doesn't matter what class you belong to, what location you are in, what time frame you are in, and what situation you are in. these yamas, they should be followed as a mahavratam. Mahavrata means it's a great vow. Vrata means a vow. When you add the prefix maha, it becomes a great vow, super vow. That means strong vow. Okay? So you have to follow these as a vow that you take in life. Sarva bhauma. Okay? Absolutely, you have, it doesn't matter. Sarva bhauma means the place. That means it's applied everywhere. Sarvabhauma means applicable everywhere. And totally avachinnaha. Chinna means you can break it, but it says avachinnaha. That means these vows cannot be broken. It doesn't matter what jati, what class you are in, what location you are in, what time frame you are in, and what situation you are in placed. Okay? They should not be broken. That's the only way you can you can practice yoga and attain total pure self-realization. So there are people are now, the commentators are saying it's impossible to do that and all that, you know, and then we'll come to some discussion on this. It's very interesting. Okay, so it says, must be followed in totality universally by an inspiring yogi with no regard to birth, place, time or circumstance or situation. And so, for example, now these, you know, the commentators say, what about a fisherman, right? A fisherman has to kill the fish to make a living. What does it mean? That means he cannot be a yogi. That means he cannot attain self-realization. You know, those are the questions that come up now. Okay, so same thing like a king or a soldier. Okay, now if he's fighting a war, there's absolutely no way that you will not kill or harm anybody. Okay. So does that mean he will not be a yogi? He cannot be a yogi, he cannot attain self-realization. I mean, this entire Bhagavad Gita, if you know the background of Bhagavad Gita, it's based on this concept that a person belonging to the warrior class called Kshatriya, and if he's put into a situation where he has to fight a war, he has no way. He has no way out. He has to fight the war. That's his law. That's his duty. That's his job. And as he fights the war, he will cause physical and damage to other people's bodies. And it just happens, right? Now, in the Gita, Krishna, you know, Lord Krishna says that's perfectly okay because that's exactly what you're supposed to do. When you do that, you know, you go to, you know, you will attain heaven, basically. You will attain good karma, good punya. Okay. So that's where, you know, some of these commentators, they are a little confused, I would say, you know, not sure what Patanjali meant, but in general, what they're saying is that, okay, if you are an aspiring yogi and your goal is to attain self-realization quickly, you have to follow these guidelines very, very authentically, truly, all right? So it becomes a vrata or a vow that you have to take. Okay, so now, so those are the five yamas. Now, even though, you know, this statement is given by Patanjali following the yamas, the niyamas are listed afterwards. But then again, commentators say, you know, it really doesn't matter. These have to be followed. Both yamas and niyamas have to be followed, you know, thoroughly, all right? But in my case, in my understanding, yamas, because they involve social interaction, they are much more important for us to follow, all right? Okay, so the niyamas are, and let me read the Sanskrit again, shaucha, santosha, tapas, swadhyaya, ishvara pranidhana. Okay, those are the five niyamas. All right, so I'm going to have somebody read the English translation here, so that, you know, everyone is engaged. Arvind, you want to read the English translation?
Sure. Niyamas consist of purity, contentment, accepting but not causing pain, study of spiritual books, and worship of God, self-surrender.
Okay. So, shaucha is cleanliness, you know, cleanliness or purity. And santosha is contentment. And tapas is, this is why I don't like Swami Satchidananda's translation here, accepting but not causing pain. That's not what tapas means in my opinion, in my understanding. Okay. Tapas is to go through a kind of a measured toughness, measured hardship, measured, you know, pain you cause to yourself. I wouldn't call the word pain, but hardship, you know. And it's measured because you're really doing it for a purpose. So we'll talk about that, okay? So what tapas means. So this is not a good translation. Okay, and then swadhyaya is study of the self. And that study of the self can be enhanced by study of the ancient scriptures, you can see. And then I can use the word scriptures. And when we say scriptures, they are the texts like Vedas, in Indian context, Vedas, Upanishads, again, Puranas, Yoga Sutras, Bhagavad Gita, and all that. But in other contexts, it might be the Quran for the people who follow Islam, Bible for the people who follow Christianity, and the many other texts which are available for people belonging to different faiths. Because these texts are supposed to contain the real truth, the ultimate truth of life. Okay. And that's why their study will guide us into understanding what the reality of life is. And then you start applying that to your life, okay? Then it gives you a better understanding of who we are. So that's what Swadhyaya is all about. Really going into the depth, basically. Going to the depth of any study that you want to understand. Okay? Very deep study. So Swadhyaya and Ishvara Pranidhanani. Ishvara Pranidhana is, Ishvara is God, okay? Ishvara is God. And then Pranidhana means surrender, a deep sense of self-surrender. Okay, so that's Ishvara Pranidhana. Now, we will come to the understanding of Ishvara when we talk about that later, okay? And at which time, I will be going back to chapter 1, all right? Chapter 1 has a very nice description of this word Ishvara, okay? Patanjali has a very precise, very definite definition and description of the attributes of Ishvara. And we have to stay within that framework when we say Ishvara Pranidhana, okay? So we'll talk about that later. That's the concept of Ishvara Pranidhana. So the five niyamas are, again, shaucha, which is purity or cleanliness, santosha, which is contentment, tapas, which is to put yourself through measured hardship, swadhyaya, which is to understand yourself through an understanding of the ancient scriptures, and then Ishvara Pranidhana, which is to recognize the presence of this entity, which Patanjali has described as Ishvara, which is a very pure soul. It's the purest soul, which never goes through any change, unlike the current, you know, the soul that we are a part of. That goes through change because it gets entangled with the prakriti or the ego. But this pure soul, this pure purusha that Patanjali has described as Ishvara, it never goes through any entanglement of any kind. That's why he says you have to surrender to that, because it's very pure, perfect, absolutely 100% perfect. Okay. All right. So now this goes into a definition of this word called Pratipaksha Bhavanam. It's a very nice concept presented by Patanjali. Okay, so the statement is, let me read the Sanskrit here. Vitarka Badhane Pratipaksha Bhavanam. Okay. So there are the few words here, Vitarka Badhane, and then Pratipaksha Bhavanam. So the words here. Vitarka is negative or opposite, negative thoughts. Badhane is when you are bothered by. Badhane means when you're bothered by. So when you're bothered by negative thoughts, what are the negative thoughts? You know, if it relates to yamas and niyamas, right? That's what we're talking about, yamas and niyamas. So if it is, we talked about ahimsa or non-violence, the negative of that would be violence. So let's say you're thinking of some violence or thinking of some untruth, you know, telling somebody a lie or stealing something or being greedy, okay? Things like that. So that's the thought, that's the action you are kind of contemplating through negative thoughts. So when that happens, he says, when disturbed by negative thoughts, the opposite or the positive ones should be thought of. Okay, this is very hard. You know, it's a very hard concept, but it's a very beautiful concept, because once you think about it, immediately, you know, your mind starts to become very peaceful. All right. So let's say you're angry and you're super angry at somebody and you're almost ready to hurt somebody. You know, with these yoga practices, what will happen is, first of all, what happens is when you practice yoga on a very regular basis, your frequency and the intensity of your anger will go down. And I can tell that from my own personal experience, all right? You know, for example, anger, right? In my own case, I really cannot remember when I was angry the last time. It could have been many years, more than 20 years at least. Okay.
I can remember. well, when I was angry.
Agree. It wasn't that long ago.
Okay, no, so that's what these concepts are. So when you practice yoga, you know, you keep these concepts in mind and then see if you can apply it. When you're very angry, can you think of love at that time? Suddenly. Okay, can you bring a feeling of love in your mind? That's negative thought, okay? So that's what he's saying, that by adopting a opposite thought of what is bothering you at that time, which is, bothering means it's a violation of one of these five yamas or niyamas. You're violating those. And those are very strong principles that Patanjali said, you're not supposed to violate, but you are. But then what happens if you are violating those, or you're in the process of violating them? Go back and think of something opposite, and it might, you know, kind of melt it away, basically. You know, you melt it away that way. You will not have that negative thought. So what are the evil actions? These are some of the comments, notes from my reading the commentaries. So, I think I've, what happened? Okay, anyway, this slide is misplaced. Okay. All right, so how do you get to that state of not causing any harm, and how do you develop these opposing thoughts? So this is the statement that Patanjali gives, and people have given a long commentary. Many commentators have spent more than 5-10 pages on this commentary, you know. So this is what it reads like. So I'm going to read the Sanskrit first. Vitarka hinsadayaha krita karita anumodita lobh krodh moha purvaka mridu madhya adhimatra dukkha jnana ananta phalaha iti pratipaksha bhavanam. All right, so what do these words mean? Like we said, vitarka are the negative thoughts. Vitarka are the thoughts which are disturbing us. And the example Patanjali gives, and everyone only gives the example of hinsa, violence. Hinsa means violence. And hinsa, etc. Patanjali says, the negative thoughts which are violence, etc. And in the discussion, not a single commentator has taken any other yama or niyama except hinsa. Just because Patanjali says hinsa, etc., it is strange, you know. I'm very surprised that nobody picked up on any other value or any other yamas or niyama. I've read, you know, dozens of commentaries on this. Very strange. Okay. So, vitarka, negative thoughts.
Subhash, sorry to interrupt, but does anybody suggest why there is that etc.? Even though they don't comment on it, but does anybody comment on why there's no commentary on it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm just wondering why, because there are five yamas and five niyamas, right? And hinsa is just one of them, ahimsa. And I, in my own mind, I start thinking of things like, you know, santosha, for example. If I'm not contented, what will happen? What's the negative of that? Or if I am not aparigraha, you know, if I want to hold something, what's the opposite of that? In my own mind, I've kind of thought about these things, you know, but I don't know, for some reason, commentators don't pick on that. I don't know, John. Maybe you and I can write a book.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay. Okay, so the words are, all these negative things, hinsa, adi means etc. So that's what it says, violence, etc. Krita means you do it yourself. That's krita. Karita means you get it done by somebody else. Okay, you hire somebody to do it. So if you want to kill somebody, you can either shoot yourself or you can hire a second, third person to kill somebody else. Or anumodita. Anumodita means you didn't hire anybody, you didn't kill anybody, but some killing happened and you approve of it. Okay? And you don't pay attention or you approve of it. Okay? So approval, anumodita means approval of somebody else doing something wrong. Okay? You're not personally involved, but you approve of it. All these, they can be done. Why? Why these things happen? Why these negative things happen? For, he says, three reasons. Why? Lobha. Lobha means greed. Greed is a very strong cause for doing negative stuff. All right? Number two is krodha, he says. Krodha means anger. Okay? You know, when I look at these things, I feel they are very interconnected. Anger happens because of greed, in my opinion, right? If you're greedy and if you don't get what you want, then you get angry. Things like that. Okay, so krodha is anger. Moha is is delusion. Delusion means that you are identifying something which is not real to something else, right? Delusion. You're deluded, basically, moha. Or infatuation. You're infatuated about something, you know, without any reason. Okay? So now these lobha, krodha, moha, or the greed, anger, and delusion, now he says they can have gradations. Okay? And the gradations are mridu, madhya, adhimatra. Mridu can be mild. That means your anger can be mild. Madhya means it's medium. Mild, medium, and strong, basically. It's like, you know, people go to a cooking place and then they want their food done either mild or medium or strong. You know, well done. So that's the same thing. So your anger could be mild, medium, or well done, in a sense. So very strong anger, medium anger, or mridu anger. Same thing with greed, same thing with delusion. All right. So these are the different gradations of what happens to our negative thoughts, negative feelings, etc. What happens as a result of all this, he says, that what you have to think about is that every one of these things, whether it's mild, medium, or strong, whether it is caused by greed, anger, or delusion, whether it is done by you or get it done by somebody else, or you approve of it, all these things are going to cause dukkha, ajnana, ananta phala. What does that mean? That they are calling, ananta means infinite, unending, okay? So they are going to cause unending dukkha. Dukkha means suffering, pain, mental pain. And ajnana means ignorance. So these things are going to be the cause for your ignorance. You know, you're already ignorant, and it's going to add on to that, and they are going to cause you suffering. So when you cause violence to somebody, you hurt somebody, it eventually is going to hurt you. Okay? You know, I mentioned this somewhere else also. There is a Buddhist saying that, anger, he says, how do you look at anger? He says, anger is like holding on to a piece of burning charcoal with the intention of hurling at somebody else to hurt somebody else. But guess who's getting hurt? You're holding on to burning piece of charcoal so you can hurt somebody else, but you're getting burnt yourself, basically. All right? So that's what Patanjali is saying, that look, your anger, okay, your greed, and then you do things like stealing somebody's money or somebody's, you know, property, or you become greedy, or you don't clean yourself, or you don't clean your environment. All these things are going to eventually cause you suffering, you suffering, not anybody else. It's caused you suffering. And it lead to into a deeper sense of ajnana or ignorance. That's the meaning of this phrase, which says, if you think of that way, then you can always bring that opposite feeling in your mind. Anger, bring in love. Okay? So all these things. Non-contentment, bring in contentment. So these are the concepts that Patanjali is now talking about. So let me read the Sanskrit words one more time. Vitarka hinsadayaha krita karita anumodita lobha krodha moha purvaka mridu madhya adhimatra dukkha ajnana ananta phala iti pratipaksha bhavanam. So this word that he is defining is pratipaksha bhavanam. That's the one which we talked about in the previous sutra, okay, number 33. And then this is the kind of the understanding of how you can develop that attitude of negative thinking, or opposite thinking, not negative. Opposite of negative. Okay. All right. So this slide actually belongs to the next sutra. I don't know why I put it here. by mistake. Okay. So the evil actions, for example, violence, again, these are all the commentators, you know, through greed, you want to kill an animal for skin and meat, you know, that's greediness. You can use the animal's skin or you can use the animal's meat, but you're greedy because you want that. Through anger, because this man has harmed me, so I should harm him. You know, that's another thing. You can get angry. And, you know, anger can come up for multiple reasons, right? There is a whole discussion of anger in the Bhagavad Gita also, where it says that anger, you know, usually when you desire something, when you have a strong attachment to something, and that desire doesn't get fulfilled, and what you're attached to and you're not able to get that, then you start getting angry. And then Bhagavad Gita goes on to say that when you're angry, you lose your mind, you lose your power of discrimination, and then you completely, you kind of destroy it, basically. Anger can destroy you. That's what Bhagavad Gita says. It's a very strong statement made there about anger in the Gita. Okay? And then through delusion, you know, the example given by somebody is that in the old days, animal sacrifice was done as a form of ritualistic sacrifice, which was supposed to give you merit or good karma or good punya. That delusion, because you're killing somebody, you're deluded, you're infatuated with that. Okay, so thoughts of violence to be suppressed by compassion and empathy. So again, once you have done this study and once you have been practicing all these concepts, there is a possibility. That's what I believe. You know, this is not what the commentator says. I believe that there's a possibility that when you are in a situation or you're angry or you want to hurt somebody or you want to steal something or you want to tell a lie, okay, then you can bring in that opposite thought. So if you're trying to be violent, you can bring in compassion or empathy, things like that, or love, you know, something like that. If you're stealing something, bring in that sense of, you know, sort of contentment. Okay, I'm okay with what I have. Let's not steal anything. Things like that. So that will happen with practice and with a lot of introspection, a lot of contemplation on these concepts. And I hope through, as we lead our life, these things will happen. So seeing the success of a dishonest person, you might be tempted to follow the example. However, opposing thoughts of honesty can bring you back to the right path. Okay. These are some of the examples given. Love for it, hatred, compassion for injury. Opposing thoughts are triggered by realizing that evil actions, physical or mental, are done by yourself, by another, on one's behalf, or approved by oneself. And these are, we already gone through this. Okay. All right, so far, any other questions or thoughts? Just getting into the concepts of the five yamas and niyamas. Right. So now we get into the individual yamas and niyamas, okay, one by one. So let's do just one or two because my throat is getting dry. I think we should stop after this. Probably because it's my third class today. So, you know, I had a class in the morning, two classes in the morning, and then this one. So. Actually, because almost on all Saturdays I have these classes, I'm actually thinking of officially making the time from 2:30 to 4 rather than 2:30 to 4:30. Will that work for everyone? Is that okay with everyone?
Whatever's best for you.
No, I'm just thinking, you know, because every time it kind of feels that my throat begins to get dry.
90 minutes is good.
Yeah,
I agree.
We'll do that in future. But let's go through this one only, the first one only, Ahimsa, all right? And then we'll stop after that. So the statement in Sanskrit is, Ahimsa pratishthayam tat sannidhau vairatyagaha. Okay, once again, ahimsa pratishthayam tat sannidhau vairatyagaha. Okay. So the meaning given is that in the presence of one firmly established in non-violence, all hostilities cease. They come to a stop. All right. So pratishtha means being established. So one who is established firmly kind of believes in non-violence. That means he has understood and he is able to apply it every situation in life, that's the person we are talking about. So the one who has 100% understood the concept of non-violence, absolutely shows no violence to anybody, then in his presence, sannidhav means in his presence. Tat sannidhav means in his presence. Vaira. Vaira means animosity or hostilities. Vaira means animosity in general. The common meaning is animosity. So Tyaga means will cease to exist. Tyaga means give up. So if you are completely established in the value of non-violence, then in your presence, whoever comes in contact with you will also give up any intention of animosity or hostility. That's the literal meaning of this sentence. Okay. Basically, you will be kind of, if you are totally non-violent, you will be giving out some rays, you know, which will influence people and they will also become non-violent in a sense. Okay. So these are some notes, again, based on my reading of these texts. You know, what is violence? You know, we can cause violence to plants, animals, humans, everything, you know, environment, you know, I should mention environment also, okay? That's what we do. A lot of us, you know, we don't pay attention, but a lot of violence is being done to the environment also. But plants, animals, humans, we know that, okay? And what causes these violent tendencies? Evil tendencies like selfishness, hatred, jealousy, anger, greed, all these things, they cause tendency to inflict injury to others. Okay, so this is exactly what we talked about earlier. These are the negative emotions that we all have, and this is what eventually will cause us anger and cause us or have us cause harm to others. Okay. And then the statement is, to nourish one's own body with the flesh of another is himsa, violence. We all know that, you know. I mention this because, you know, there's a very strong concept of non-meat eating in India, okay? There are many people who don't eat meat in India. And, of course, the number has kind of come down now. There are more people eating meat now than they used to be. But it was all based on this very basic concept of non-violence. Ahimsa was a very strong concept. It still is. Okay? Because to kill an animal is obviously violence, right? Now, when I look back at all the texts that we read in the ancient times, you know, Gita or the Yoga Sutras or even the Vedas and Upanishads, I have not found so far any precise mention that you should not eat meat. All they say is, do not cause harm to others. But it's a corollary from there, you know, it's a deduction from there that people have taken it to mean non-meat eating. And then that has become a very strong kind of a foundation principle in most of the Indian thought, that you should not eat meat, okay? So there are large populations in India that do not eat meat. Like when I was growing up, my mother came from a family that absolutely ate no meat. So my mother never touched meat in her entire life. Similarly with my wife, she never touched meat in her life, entire life, because that's the strong background they had. My father, he grew up in a family which was non-meat eating, but then he went to UK for some higher education, and there he started meeting eats, and when he came back, he continued to eat meat. I myself grew up eating no meat at all, but I started eating meat when I graduated from school, from college. Things have happened. I'm just giving you these examples to show you how strong that feeling of non-eating is in the Indian system.
I have a question. On that first bullet, you say you should have this toward all living creatures like plants. So it seems like by eating plants, you would be doing violence to the plants, right?
Yeah, you know, that's a very strong question, because everyone's, you know, when you start talking about violence and causing harm, people say that, no, plants have life, right? Plants have life, you know, and if you eat plant food, then you're causing harm to plants. So there are, you know, people give all kinds of reasons. I mean, you have to survive, right, first of all. And there are these levels or gradations of consciousness, they say. And these gradations go from humans to animals to plants to some other, you know, things like that. So especially when you talk about plants, you know, you don't cause harm to the environment by not uprooting them, not killing them, etc. But as far as eating the fruit, they say you should generally consume only those foods that have dropped from the plant after they are ripe on their own, basically. Then you're causing no harm. Okay. So, but that also, again, you know, then they go back one step further. They say, okay, plants have very low level of consciousness, and because we need that for our survival, let's do that. Animals have a higher level of consciousness, so let's not kill them. That's the kind of, you know, the logic and reasoning people give when they talk about nonviolence towards animals and plants. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this?
Subhash, I know when we were during the Yoga Sutras intensive we did, you and I had exchanged some emails on this subject, and we were looking and talked a little bit about the Manusmriti.
Yes.
And some of the guidance. I know that's not scripture. But there were a number of sections there describing, I guess, conduct to be followed, lack of a better way of putting it, like for good living. And part of that conduct was treatment of animals and sort of describing things not to do. And like, for instance, I just pulled up that email talking about like meat can never be obtained without injury to living creatures, and injury to sentient beings is detrimental to the attainment of heavenly bliss. Let him therefore shun the use of meat. Now, again, I know it's not scripture and it's not on the same level as the sutras, but so there was some historical basis for, I guess, cultural reasons, right? Yes. That emanate out of scripture and
yes,
and culture. So there is other guidance, I guess.
Yes, more I would say cultural guidance than scriptural guidance, I would think, right?
Right.
But it's a very strong, you know, feeling in India. And of course, like I said, more people are eating meat now with all these McDonald's growing everywhere in the country. Mm. So more people are eating meat now. But in my case, for example, I started eating meat when I was around 25, and I ate meat until about I was 45 or so. And then since then I quit. I haven't had any meat for 35 years now. So just happens.
Subhash, I have a question or a comment too on the issue of ahimsa as it relates to nonviolence towards oneself. I know I've like read some commentary. I mean, most of what we're talking about today is ahimsa as it relates to others or other creatures and things like that. But I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that, or you can comment on ahimsa as it relates to yourself, you know, and speaking poorly to yourself or thinking negative thoughts about yourself or taking drugs, alcohol, eating meat, as being an act of violence against yourself.
Right. So, you know, on the very next slide, I said, apply ahimsa not only to others, but to yourself as well.
Sorry.
Okay. So I've given an example, hurting yourself by overeating, for example, or performing asana beyond your capability. That's causing violence to yourself. And then we, through self-destructive behavior like caused by fear and guilt, that's all violence to yourself. Okay? So, I have thought about that and I put these thoughts here, basically. And I'm going back to the previous slide because I want to talk about this. Ahimsa can be done through action, thought, or speech. Okay? And we all do that. Through action, of course, we know how to hurt somebody through action by, throwing a stone or throwing some bullet on somebody. That's physical, kicking somebody, slapping somebody. But thought and speech, the violence that you do through speech, this is the most damaging, most harmful, and it's longer lasting. If you cause damage through speech, it can last for a lifetime. People don't get over that for a very, very, very long time. Same thing with thought, Your thoughts will appear on your mind, on your face, You may have absolutely nothing wrong to say, but if you have negative thoughts on your mind, they'll come up on your face. Your facial expression will show that, okay? So that's why they say ahimsa. And in the Bhagavad Gita, they say exactly the same thing through, you should not have any kind of violence through either action, thought, or speech, okay? So that's also in the Bhagavad Gita, there is a statement there, very identical. Okay. And again, things like food wastage is a form of violence against those who sleep hungry. I know this is somebody's comment from one of the commentaries. Love involving demands and expectations entails violence both to self and others. Just think about these things, Like I said, I've pulled these comments from various commentaries that I read. People put their own thoughts. Emotional violence in relationships, harsh, abusive language, angry outbursts, emotional judgments, sarcasm, skillful manipulation. And we all do that from time to time. And these are all harmful because they are injuring others and ourselves, basically. They involve both. If you have harsh or abusive language, you're hurting both. More yourself, actually. Anything that's angry outbursts, again, you're hurting yourself more than anybody else. Okay. Any other thoughts on anger ahimsa?
I was thinking, I think a lot about, I have thought a lot about diet and violence and eating, probably more so than thinking about emotional violence in relationships or to oneself. But I think what you said before just kind of made something click. That a soldier during war has to kill. I'm trying to go back in my notes. Or that a fisherman can only kill. And just thinking about the circumstances that we live in. If it was necessary for my survival to eat an animal, it would be different than living in a place where food is abundant. And so it's sort of not like a, I guess that everything is contextual, mm-hmm. but that the universal truth underneath it applies kind of.
Right. So,
I don't know. That was super helpful. Thank you.
So your thought is that, we are put in situations where we have to have some violence even just for our survival. And I agree with that. That's what we were saying. As a soldier, you have to kill. As a fisherman, you have to kill fish. Talking of that, there's a story that I'm reminded of, and I like to tell that all the time. Again, it comes from a Buddhist source somewhere. There was a Buddhist guy who was a soldier, and he was in a battlefield, right? Fighting battle with his enemy. And this was, and came to hand-to-hand fight, So this guy, was able to subdue the enemy, the guy he was fighting with. So he has a dagger or a sword in his hand. and he raises his sword. And this guy is on the ground, and he has his, and he has put his foot on his chest. Okay? This guy is totally now, he's kind of, he has defeated basically. So he raises his sword, and while he's raising his sword, this guy who's on the ground under his foot, he spits on his face out of disgust. Okay? That you son of so-and-so, you know, he spits on his face. And his dagger freezes there completely. It's frozen. He doesn't move now. So now this guy is in suffering. He says, just kill me, man. Why don't you kill me? I'm already under your control. I cannot take it anymore. Just kill me. So he's holding his dagger with his sword now. He says, look, I cannot kill you at this moment. He says, why not? He says, because by spitting, you have made me angry. Okay? And now my ego is working. Before that, I was a soldier. I was only doing my duty. I was not working out of anger. I was not working out of ego. I was doing my duty purely from my intellectual point of view. Now you have made me angry. If I kill you now, I'll be committing a murder. That's a sin. I don't want to commit a sin by committing a murder. So unless my anger goes away, I'm not going to kill you. Do you understand the concept here? So he says, I'm not going to kill you until my anger goes away. And then I'm back to my duty.
So goes back to ego and intellect?
Yes.
That's what it resonates to me.
Exactly right. Uh-huh. Okay. Now, there's a, you know, this is a story that is mentioned in this, in the case of this gentleman by the name Swami Narayana. There is a very famous religious sect, which is more common in the state of Gujarat in India. Anybody heard of this Swami Narayana sect? Okay. There are Swaminarayana temples all over the place in the world. And they're some of the most beautiful temples in terms of their architecture and structure and all that. They make some amazingly beautiful temples. Okay. So there, the founder of this sect, his original name was Neelakantha. He as a child. And then, of course, he became Swami Narayana when he became enlightened and all that. So the story goes, you know, that this guy, this kid, as a teenager, he was only about 12 or 13 years old when he started, you know, going in search of enlightenment. And he was going from village to village, walking across. So this guy arrives in a village called Shripur, okay? And then when he arrives at the village, you know, the villagers told him that, look, this village has been terrorized by a lion who comes at night and then damages, you know, a lot of things, and it kills people if you're outside. So they strongly urged him not to stay outside, because this kid was always staying outside under a tree. You know, he would spend the night there, and then they always would go and ask for food from others, right? That's how they lived. So they said, you know, we'll give you shelter in a temple or in somebody's house, but don't stay outside, you know, because it's very dangerous. This lion comes every night and it causes a lot of damage. But this guy says, you know, I don't have any fear in my mind, you know, I'm not going to cause any harm to anybody, so why bother? So he says, okay, I'm going to stay outside. So again, you know, he sits under a tree. Usually under a tree, there are platforms, you know, made so he can sleep on that. So he sleeps under a tree. And then this lion comes at night and comes closer to this guy, looks at him, you know, and then he sits down basically. And then these villagers, you know, when they wake up in the morning, they are absolutely certain that this guy would have been killed by now, this kid. And they come out and they are absolutely amazed to see this sight where this lion is now sitting at the feet of this child, of this teenager child. And he's, you know, happily sleeping. So because he was so deeply embedded with this value of ahimsa, that nobody causes any harm. Okay, there's a movie, you know, that goes by the same name, Swami Narayan's movie. You know, they've shown this in that movie also. It's a part of his life story, and apparently it's a real story. It's not too old; it's about 100 years old, they say. So this happened actually in a village. Okay. So in New Jersey, John, I believe there's a very beautiful Swami Narayan temple. Have you been there? Okay.
I have not, no. Where do you remember what town it's in?
You could check with somebody. I forget where it is, but they say it's very beautiful.
I don't know. I'll do a search and see.
Yeah, it's a Swami Narayan temple in New Jersey. It's not too old. They say very recent, I think. Somebody said that it's very nice, very beautiful. Like I said, they make beautiful temples. The temples are famous all over the world.